Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to First Western Trust Bank's final webinar of the year from the Wealth Advisory Group. This webinar is entitled Set Yourself Up for a Successful 2012 with Year-End Tax Planning Tips. I'm Melissa Montgomery Fitzsimmons. I'm the Director of Wealth Planning here at First Western, and this time of year is very busy in the wealth planning, legal, and tax world. We work with our clients and their advisors to get many of these last-minute tax strategies in place before December 31st. We thought it would be helpful to speak to a larger group of our clients via a webinar, and then, of course, we're always happy to meet with you one-on-one as appropriate. Our presenters today are two of our top wealth advisors. David Cerullo is a CPA and also a certified financial planner. Bill Line is an estate planning attorney. We thought that it would be helpful to spend some time on planning strategies that are specific to business owners, strategies that are specific to executives, and then strategies that apply to everyone. So without further ado, I will turn it over to Dave and Bill.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you for the introduction, Melissa. I'll be discussing the first half of today's webinar. We're about a year into the Tax Relief, Unemployment Insurance Reauthorization, and Job Creation Act of 2010, or the 2010 Tax Act for short. 2010 Tax Act extended lower tax rates and provided a short-term relief from a high level of uncertainty. Unfortunately for taxpayers, no single tax reform proposal has garnered enough support, which has made tax planning both complex and uncertain for post-2012. Although tax planning is difficult, the silver lining in this cloud of uncertainty is that taxpayers find themselves enjoying relatively favorable income and transfer tax rates and rules for the remainder of 2011 and 2012. What we do know at this point is that tax rates are scheduled to increase and various tax benefits are scheduled to sunset by the end of 2012. In today's webinar, we'll present some planning ideas for you to consider before the end of this year and into 2012. I'm going to begin the discussion today with some possible year-end income tax strategies, and Bill Line will discuss transfer tax strategies in the second half of the presentation. So I'd like to begin with a cartoon here that really sums things up for the past year. A good portion of today's discussion is only about temporary tax law for 2011 and 2012, so more changes to look forward to in the future. I plan to focus on seven areas of income tax planning today, specifically income and deduction shifting, the alternative minimum tax, or AMT, executive compensation, which would include stock options, bonuses, and deferred compensation, charitable contribution planning, gains and losses from capital assets, business deductions, more specifically depreciation, and some energy tax credits. Most of the strategies I discussed today should be reviewed every year, but I'll also highlight a few strategies that should be reviewed carefully for the possible changes in the income tax rates beginning in 2013. So I just want to quickly show you the current tax rates and possible changes in income tax rates beginning in 2013. The first being the highest marginal ordinary income tax rate. For 2011-2012, 35%, slated to go to 39.6% in 2013. AMT is essentially the same at 28% flat tax. Long-term capital gains rate is scheduled to increase by 5% from 15% to 20%. And then qualified dividends are expected to go away if nothing has happened by the end of 2012. And be taxed at ordinary income tax rates, or essentially 39.6% in the highest. And then two new taxes that come into play in 2013, Medicare surtax on portfolio income and Medicare surtax on wages, 3.8% and 9.9% respectively. Both of these taxes do not get kicked in until about $250,000 of income for married filing jointly. And then corporate rates, as you can see, remain the same at 35%. So let's start with income and deduction shifting. A tremendous number of variables affect how a particular item of income is taxed and ultimately your overall tax liability for the year. And timing of income and deductible expenses can affect both the rate you pay and when you pay. By regularly reviewing your year-to-date income, expenses, and potential tax, you may be able to time income and expenses in a way that reduces or at least defers your tax liability. The Bush tax cuts remain in effect through the end of 2012, so there's no difference in the income tax rates that generally apply in 2011 and 2012. Although tax rates aren't predicted to change from 2011 to 2012, your income may not be so constant. For example, an individual taxpayer would time his income events so that taxable income is about even for both 2011 and 2012. If a taxpayer anticipates a higher tax bracket for 2012, they may want to accelerate income into 2011 and vice versa. Compensation, such as bonuses, stock options, and deferred compensation, generally can offer some flexibility in timing, with stock options probably being the most flexible. If you are retired and do not have compensation, IRAs are also a good planning tool for income shifting. You can look to convert a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA, which would bring in ordinary income on the conversion, or you can take additional distributions into income from your traditional IRA. The same considerations should be reviewed for your deductions. We will discuss the importance of state taxes and charitable contributions in more detail, but both are common deductions that can be timed to maximize your tax benefit. For example, if you sell a business in a particular year, you may want to prepay your state income taxes due by the end of the year or make a large charitable contribution. Or if you're subject to alternative minimum tax in 1 year, then you may want to defer any state or real estate taxes until the next year where you may not be subject to AMT. And this will actually lead us into the next planning topic, AMT. When the AMT was established, it was intended to apply to higher income taxpayers. However, the exemption amounts were not indexed for inflation. In recent years, more and more taxpayers have become subject to AMT. Congress has responded by raising the exemption amounts on a year-by-year basis as a temporary patch. Eliminating the AMT or indexing the exemption remains a target of comprehensive individual tax reform. AMT relief has been provided through 2011 through an increase in the AMT exemption amount. Generally, the increase in the exemption amount is extended from year to year, but it is possible that Congress will not increase the exemption for 2012 and let it sink to prior levels. So how does AMT exactly work? AMT is essentially an alternative tax system that adds back certain deductions and also has other additions and subtractions that we will not have time to get into today. The AMT taxable income is calculated and taxed at a flat 28% tax rate. Then the higher of the AMT or ordinary tax is used. I have a chart here listing some of the most common types of deductions and which apply to regular tax and AMT. Probably the top two are the most common, the state and local income or sales tax and the real estate tax. Both of those are deductible for regular tax purposes, but not for AMT purposes. Then the other three most common are all 2% miscellaneous itemized deductions being investment expenses, which are basically portfolio management fees, professional fees, which are accounting and attorney fees, and then unreimbursed business expenses. Again, all deductible for regular tax, but not for AMT purposes. So I have an example here that shows a little bit how the AMT tax planning can work and benefit for you. So I've assumed here in tax year one, a taxpayer has a sale of a business generating $2.5 million of total income, $1.5 million being ordinary and $1 million being long-term capital gain. We have other itemized deductions of $150,000, which would be mortgage interest, charitable contributions, etc. And then we have the state income taxes of $125,000, so the total deductions of $275,000. I'm assuming the state income taxes are prepaid in tax year one here, so the taxable income is $2,225,000. Then I have two different scenarios for tax year number two. The first one correlates to the example here. State taxes are paid prepaid in year one, and the second column is tax state taxes are paid on the due date of the return in tax year number two. So in tax year one, by prepaying the state income taxes, you're essentially saving 35% of $125,000 or $43,750 in federal income taxes. In tax year two, because of the reduced income, I'm assuming the taxpayer is subject to AMT and therefore may not receive a full deduction for the state income taxes of $125,000. If these taxes are not prepaid and you are an AMT in year two, this is a permanent loss of the deduction. So it's very important to do year-end planning to see if you need to prepay your state taxes. In this example, it definitely would make sense because of the $43,000 federal deduction or federal tax savings. We're going to talk a little bit about executive compensation. Executives are often rewarded with non-qualified deferred compensation, stock options, or restricted stock. To keep your taxes to a minimum, it's important to plan for these complicated forms of compensation. This means both understanding the unique rules that apply to each compensation type and taking steps to use them to your advantage. The different types of stock options and deferred compensation arrangements should be reviewed, but I'm only going to discuss incentive stock options, or ISOs, today. With the possible income tax changes on the horizon, I believe ISO planning is the most important for 2011 year-end tax considerations. I believe an example is the best way to show you how an ISO works and how to plan for the exercise of the option. I'm not going to spend too much time on the details of an exercise of an ISO, but I did want to show you how they work and how you can benefit by exercising before the end of 2011. So in the example here, I have an assumed exercise price of $50, assumed number of shares of 2,000, and then the market values for 2011, 12, and 13 on the right side here. So as you can see in column 1, 2011, the actual cash to exercise the option would be $100,000. That's essentially the exercise price of $50 times the number of shares of 2,000. As you will notice, there's no ordinary income or long-term gains on the exercise of the options. This is one of the unique abilities of an incentive stock option. But there is an AMT adjustment of $50,000. And that's essentially calculated by taking the exercise price, the market value and the date of exercise, which I'm assuming is 12/1/2011, at $75 minus the exercise price of $50, or $25 times 2,000. Because that is an AMT add-back, I'm assuming that the taxpayer is being kicked into AMT and subject to $10,000 of AMT taxes. Now, what I did want to express is the difference between 2012 and 2013. So if we sold the option on 12/2/2012, when the price was $100, the capital gain would be $100,000. Again, this is calculated at $100 minus the exercise price, or in this case, the cost basis, so 50 times 2,000 or $100,000 in gain. When you do sell an ISO, you do receive AMT adjustment for what you previously recognized. So we have a subtraction for AMT of $50,000, and you do get a credit for any tax subject to AMT that was related to the ISO, so that $10,000 would come back. So the capital gains for 2012 would be $15,000 in federal tax, which is essentially $100,000 times the 15% rate. If you wait and sell that ISO in 2013, then your tax rate would be 5% increase, or $20,000, assuming the 2013 capital gains rate goes to 20%. So as I noted on the previous slide, you should review your ISOs before the end of 2011 for a possible exercise. There's a limited window of opportunity to take advantage of the 15% long-term capital gain as it applies to the one-year holding period for the ISOs after exercise. This, of course, assumes the capital gain rates go to 20% in 2013. I've also made a note here that when planning for an ISO exercise, you should combine with your AMT tax planning. So let's move on to charitable contribution planning. Charitable contributions can be one of the most flexible planning tools available to a taxpayer. Long-term capital gain property, such as publicly traded stock, can be one of the most efficient ways to make a charitable contribution. If you sold a stock that you've held for more than a year with a fair market value of $50,000 and a cost of only $10,000, you would pay a long-term capital gains tax on $40,000 gain or $6,000 in federal taxes. If instead you donated the stock to a qualified charitable organization, then you would receive a full fair market value deduction of the $50,000 for the stock and also never have to pay the $6,000 of long-term capital gains tax. Another charitable planning tool was part of the 2010 Tax Act. Congress retroactively reinstated the ability to make direct qualified charitable distributions, or QCDs for short, from your IRA in amounts up to $100,000. The QCD can only be done by IRA owners who are at least age 70 and a half, in other words, subject to required minimum distributions, or RMDs. This provision is available through December 31st, 2011. The $100,000 QCD can be used to satisfy your required minimum distributions. This means the IRA owner who doesn't need the RMD for income can direct the distribution to charity of his or her choice. In addition, the distribution does not count for determining adjusted gross income or any other modified adjusted gross income calculations. As we discussed before, timing your deductions can be important to take advantage of the tax brackets from year to year. Donor-advised funds and private foundations can play a key role in timing your charitable contributions. I've included an example to show you how a donor-advised fund can save you additional taxes by front-loading charitable contributions in a tax year with a large income tax event, such as the sale of a business. So in this case, we're assuming in 2011, there is total ordinary income of $1 million. We have other itemized deductions of $60,000, and then I'm assuming the charitable contribution to the Donor Advised Fund, or DAF as here, is $100,000. So in this case, the tax rate that the taxpayer would be in is the top ordinary bracket of 35%, so the potential savings from the charitable contribution of $100,000 would be $35,000 or 35% in the contribution. Now, as opposed to doing the charitable contributions over $10,000 over 10 years, we can see the difference in 2012 and 2013. So instead, if you did not front load your contributions, the tax rates are really the biggest difference here. So in 2012, I'm assuming $200,000 of ordinary income, so the tax bracket would be 25%. So your savings on a $10,000 contribution would only be 25% or $2,500 in this case. And even if the ordinary tax rates increase at the end of 2012, the taxpayer would be in a 28% bracket or would be saving only 28% of the $10,000 contribution. So there's about a 7 to 10% benefit from front-loading your charitable contributions with a donor-advised fund. So the next strategy we're going to talk about are gains and losses on capital assets. Consideration should be given to a taxpayer's capital assets so that recognition of capital gains and losses at year-end are timed to minimize net gains and maximize deductible losses. Tax loss harvesting strategies should also be considered before year-end to accumulate losses to offset future gains that would be taxed at a higher rate. Also of concern is whether the maximum rate for capital gains will rise from 15 to 20% or higher after year-end 2012 because of the scheduled expiration of the Bush tax cuts. Acceleration of a sale of a capital asset should be considered to take advantage of the lower rates. This would include a review of your portfolio assets and real estate holdings with unrealized long-term capital gains. This would not have to be done before the end of 2011, but definitely should be considered in 2012. Also, if you're contemplating an installment sale in which taxes are paid over time as payments are received, then you should strongly consider electing out of the installment sale treatment to take advantage of today's 15% long-term rate versus potentially higher future tax rates. I've noted qualified small business stock due to some favorable tax benefits. To qualify, the small business must be engaged in an active trader business and must have assets that exceed do not exceed $50 million. If you sell qualifying small business stock at a loss, you can treat up to $100,000, assuming married filing jointly, as ordinary rather than a capital loss, regardless of your holding period. There were some key changes that occurred for 2010 and 2011 from the 2010 Tax Act. Generally, taxpayers selling qualified small business stock are allowed to exclude up to 50% of the gain if they've held the stock for more than 5 years. The 2010 Tax Act increases the exclusion to 100% for stock acquired after September 27, 2010 and before January 1, 2012. If the stock was acquired after February 19, 2009 and before September 26, 2010, the exclusion is 75%, and the five-year holding period requirement still applies. I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about some business deductions now. Three depreciation-related breaks have been significantly enhanced by the 2010 Tax Act. The 2010 Tax Act increases the additional first-year bonus depreciation allowance to 100% for new, not used, property acquired and placed in service after September 8, 2010 and before January 1, 2012. For property acquired and placed in service in 2012, bonus depreciation is scheduled to return to 50% and will expire after 2012 if Congress does not take any action. 2010 Tax Act also allows you to expense up to $500,000 of qualified property. This is most commonly referred to as Section 179 expense, and the expense begins to phase out dollar for dollar when total asset acquisition for the year exceeds $2 million. But unlike bonus depreciation, the property can be used. For 2012, the Section 179 expense amount drops to $125,000. 2010 Tax Act also extends through 2011 the accelerated depreciation available for qualified leasehold improvement, restaurant and retail improvement property. Typically, this property had a recovery period of 39 years, but is shortened to 15 years for 2011. All of the above depreciation breaks should again be timed with your expected income for 2011 versus future years. For example, if you were in a low tax bracket for 2011, you may want to elect out of bonus depreciation and Section 179 expense. You would then depreciate the property in future years where income is expected to be higher. The last piece relating to the income tax I'm going to discuss today is energy incentives. For 2011, the non-business energy property credit of up to 30% of the cost incurred is available for qualifying property, including windows, exterior doors, insulation, fans, furnaces, water heaters, and other property meeting certain energy standards. I've listed a little more detail in the slide here for your reference. There is also a tax credit available through 2016 for the installation of certain energy-efficient property, such as geothermal heat pumps, solar energy panels, probably the most common, small wind turbines, and fuel cells. The credit is 30% of the cost with no maximums, with the exception to fuel cells, as noted on the slide. I'm now going to turn it over to Bill to discuss transfer tax planning strategies.
Thanks, Dave. That was really great information. And thank you to all of our clients and associates in attendance today. We hope that everyone found Dave's information helpful and that you'll find my comments on transfer taxes useful as well. The topics I'll be discussing, like Dave's topics, are rather time-sensitive. I'll provide just a bit of background on the tax code, and then I'll provide some ideas for planning in the short and midterm. So what are transfer taxes? Simply put, a transfer tax is a tax assessed on the transfer of ownership of property from one person to another. There are many different kinds of transfer taxes. However, the transfer taxes I will be focusing on today will be the estate tax, that is to say a tax paid after a taxpayer's death by his or her estate based on the estate's value, the gift tax, a tax assessed on the lifetime transfer of property, and then the generation skipping transfer tax, or GST, which is a tax paid in addition to the estate tax or gift tax if you make a transfer of property to an individual more than one generation removed from you. So a very, very brief history of tax law. Prior to 2001, the estate tax, gift tax, and GST tax applied to transfers in excess of $1 million. Transfers in excess of $1 million were taxed at approximately 55%. In the Bush era, we saw the passage of the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act of 2001, or EGTRA, which provided for a gradual phase-out and repeal of the estate tax and generation skipping transfer tax. However, the gift tax exclusion remained at $1 million. That law expired on December 31st, 2001, and paved the way for some new legislation. At the end of 2010, the 2010 Tax Act that David's been discussing became law. In the transfer tax regime, the 2010 Act provides for a unified estate, gift, and generation skipping transfer tax exclusion amount. The amount excluded from taxes is an historically high $5 million with a correspondingly low tax rate of 35%. The 2010 Tax Act also introduced the idea of portability of the estate tax exclusion between spouses. In simple terms, portability of the federal estate tax exemption between married couples means that if the first spouse dies and doesn't use up all of his or her federal exemption from estate taxes, then the exemption that the deceased spouse didn't use will be transferred to the surviving spouse's exemption so that he or she can use the deceased spouse's unused exemption plus his or her own exemption when the surviving spouse later dies. Unfortunately, the 2010 Tax Act provisions are to sunset at the end of 2012. Then what happens? I think really we have three different possible scenarios. One is that Congress does nothing. In this case, the 2010 Tax Act would expire and transfer tax rates would return to pre-2001 levels, meaning a $1 million estate tax exclusion and a 55% tax rate. Or another scenario could be that we'd have more temporary law and continued uncertainty. And finally, the third scenario would be permanent tax legislation, which would most likely be a political result of some fashion. The question then is, what can we do to plan? And the answer to that seems to fall under one of three headings as well. We can implement plans regardless of the decisions made by Congress and do so by the end of 2011. Prepare to implement by the end of 2012. Or implement plans now regardless of timing. In light of the options we have, I've included this table simply for reference and to illustrate where tax rates are going if the 2010 Tax Act expires without new legislation being enacted. the long and the short of this table is that absent new law, taxes will go up and the amount exempted from taxes will be decreased. Not a very favorable result. I thought we'd provide a few strategies that you could implement now in the short term, meaning prior to December 31st of this year. Our first suggestion would be the possibility of utilizing intra-family loans. According to the IRS, a loan can be made to any friend or family member without being considered a taxable gift as long as the interest rate on that loan is equal to or greater than the AFR. This is the applicable federal rate established monthly by the IRS. The current AFR for a short-term loan of up to 3 years is 0.2%. The AFR for a midterm loan of 3 to 9 years is 1.27%, and for loans of over 9 years, the AFR is 2.76%. So imagine the advantages a parent could offer their children at these low rates. An intrafamily loan can be a tremendous advantage to the lender as well as the borrower. The loan may offer the family member lender a higher return than some of their other investment options, and provide a consistent stream of income while keeping the transaction in the family rather than paying another lender. Family loans can be used for any purpose under the code. They can be used to pay off high interest debt, purchase a home or business, or even start an investment portfolio for a younger generation. As long as the investment outperforms the AFR, the intrafamily loan will be beneficial to both the family member making the loan as well as the family member receiving the loan. Another strategy to implement before the end of this year, we encourage this really every year, is to make use of annual exclusion gifts, currently of $13,000 per year. The gift tax annual exclusion is a great way to reduce your future estate taxes while keeping assets within your family as well. It allows every individual to give away a specified amount of money to an unlimited number of persons without any gift or estate tax consequences. In 2011, the amount of the annual exclusion is $13,000, and that's indexed for inflation in future years. Remember, gifts don't need to be cash, and the gifts can be made in trust if you're worried about the gift being wasted by a recipient. Also remember that annual gifting is a use-it-or-lose-it strategy, as noted here on the screen. If you don't make an annual exclusion gift in 2011, you don't get to double your gift in 2012. Educational plans, we encourage you to fund educational plans fully. While plans vary a bit from state to state, most plans are sponsored by individual states to encourage individuals and families to save for future higher education expenses. The most commonly known plan is a 529 plan. 529 refers to Section 529 of the Internal Revenue Code, which established tax guidelines for this type of college investment plan. While these contributions are not deductible from the donor's federal income tax liability, many states provide state income tax deductions for all or part of the contribution of the donor. Beyond the potential state income tax deduction possibilities, a prime benefit of the 529 plan is that principal grows tax deferred and distributions for a beneficiary's college costs are exempt from tax. These are just a few of the year-end strategies we encourage you to consider employing this year. There are, of course, other strategies to implement as well. The next strategy is what you can do before the Tax Relief Act expires at the end of next year, the end of 2012. You can make gifts to take advantage of the $5 million gift tax exclusion, consider grant or retained annuity trusts, establish family limited partnerships, create spousal lifetime access trusts, and there are some other vehicles as well. Utilizing all or part of your $5 million gift tax exclusion can be very tax efficient. To make a taxable transfer of $1 million to family members, you must either pay a gift tax if the transfer occurs during life or an estate tax if the transfer occurs at death. The tax rates on gifts and estates are both 35%, so you'd think that the transfer costs would be identical, but they're really not. Let's say you want to get $1 million to your kids. That's the illustration we have here for you on the screen. In this table, you'll see that under the current law, if you make a gift during life, a 35% tax would be assessed to the transfer. Therefore, in this example, the federal government would receive a $350,000 tax. If you wait until death to get $1 million to your kids, the federal government would take $538,000. The lifetime gift would therefore save $188,000 in taxes. The lesson here being that it's a lot more expensive to wait to make gifts at death rather than making the same gift during life. Another good vehicle is a grantor retained annuity trust, or GRAT. The basic idea with a GRAT is to take an asset, usually an appreciating asset of some sort, place it in trust for a period of time while retaining an annuity payment interest in the trust. For example, let's say you have $1 million of stock that pays a dividend of 10%, or $100,000 per year. You could then establish a GRAT with, for instance, a 13-year term, and then transfer the $1 million of stock to the GRAT. Each year, the $100,000 dividend is paid to the GRAT, and the GRAT then pays a required $100,000 annuity to you. The amazing part is that under the Internal Revenue Code, the value of the gift transfer to the GRAT, in this example, could be as low as about $14,000 because of that retained annuity interest. This gift would not qualify for an annual exclusion, and you'd need to use $14,000 of your $5 million lifetime gift exemption or pay a gift tax on the $14,000 gift. At the end of the GRAT term, or 13 years in this example, you would have received $1.3 million, $100,000 per year for 13 years in annuity payments. The remainder value in the GRAT is the stock and would still be valued at $1 million, assuming no appreciation, or more if the stock does appreciate. The stock would then be distributed to the remainder beneficiaries, usually your children. In this case, your children would have received an asset worth $1 million or more, but you would have only reported a gift of $14,000. This is a very powerful tool. Congress does not like this strategy, however, and has threatened to restrict or eliminate the ability to do GRAT planning. For now, however, GRATs remain a good tool to reduce state tax exposure. It makes a good deal of sense to explore the feasibility of GRAT planning in the near future, even though we have a $5 million exemption amount until the end of next year, because if tax rates do increase at the end of 2012, as they're likely to do, advisors will be very busy setting up GRATs and other vehicles for clients. Family limited partnerships are often used as a way to consolidate financial holdings, involve children in business and financial matters, while generating various tax advantages as well. These vehicles offer estate, gift, and income tax savings for the family. Careful planning is required to set up the family limited partnership, or FLIP, so it meets the goals of the family and the requirements of tax law. For example, a FLIP could be set up by you and your spouse who contribute $1 million of stock or real estate to the FLIP in return for general partnership units and limited partnership units. Normally, the general partners have a 1% interest in the family limited partnership, and limited partners have a 99% interest. You and your spouse could then embark on a plan of giving limited partnership units to your children and grandchildren while retaining general partnership units that control the FLIP. Through this gifting and through discounting the ownership interests allowed by the IRS, your children would eventually end up owning the assets they would have otherwise received through your estate. But with the FLIP, those assets would have passed your children free from all estate taxes. If the FLIP is structured correctly, there are several tax advantages that may be leveraged. Estate and gift tax savings may be achieved by removing appreciating assets from the estate of the senior family member. Utilizing annual gift tax exclusion will save transfer taxes as well. We can further reduce estate and gift taxes through using valuation discounts, such as minority interest and lack of marketability discounts. These discounts can usually be in the range of 20 to 35%. Income tax savings may be achieved by deflecting and allocating income to lower generation family members who are in lower tax brackets than the senior family members. The bottom line here is that you can remove assets from your ownership while retaining control of them, and this is all accomplished while saving taxes. Final vehicle I'll discuss here today is the Spousal Lifetime Access Trust, or SLAT. While many high net worth married couples may like to take advantage of their $5 million gift tax exemption currently in place, they may be reluctant to do so because they lose access to the gifted property's income and principal. One strategy to keep the income and principal within the reach of the donor is a Spousal Lifetime Access Trust. In simple terms, a SLAT is an irrevocable trust set up by one spouse for the benefit of the other spouse. For example, assume a husband creates a SLAT for the benefit of his wife and funds it with his $5 million gift tax exemption. During the wife's lifetime, the trustee, who may also be the wife, can distribute to the wife income and principal as needed for her support. Thus, the husband has indirect access to the trust income and principal while not owning it in his estate. When the wife passes away, the trust property, including the appreciation, passes estate tax-free to the children and possibly even more remote descendants. An added benefit of a SLAT is that it may protect beneficiaries from creditors, including potential ex-spouses of children. Access to trust assets is available only to the grantor's spouse and or other beneficiaries, but not to the grantor him or herself. Thus, the grantor has only indirect access to the trust property through his or her spouse. Therefore, divorce or death of the spouse will eliminate this limited access. So we really need to be careful of those of that kind of pitfall in SLAT planning. There are many other vehicles we can help clients put in place. I would simply stress the importance of consulting with us prior to the end of this year so that we don't miss any possible planning opportunities.
Thanks, Dave and Bill. As I mentioned at the beginning of the webinar, this is a very busy time in the wealth planning, legal, and tax world. So if you would like help in understanding more of the details of these strategies and whether they might be right for your situation, I encourage you to call or email either Dave or Bill or the wealth advisors who are in your area, and I'll be glad to put you in touch with your local wealth advisor if you haven't met him or her yet. We work in conjunction with your existing team of advisors and can guide you through this process and expedite the process so that you can meet the 12/31 deadline. We are here to help. Please call on us. Thanks, everyone. If you have questions, please email them, and we'll respond within the next 24 hours. Thanks again.